Positively Psychic.
Positively Psychic.
2 hours of fascinating interviews and call-ins with your host, the Positively Psychic medium, Mark Christopher Nelson.
Positively Psychic.
During the show, Mark will invite you to call in to speak with him and his guests. Call in for a free reading and contact your guides, guardian angels, friends, and loved ones on the other side.
Positively Psychic.
Join the online chat to share thoughts and experiences with like-minded souls at www.para-x.com.
Positively Psychic.
Listen in now as the Positively Psychic medium, Mark Christopher Nelson, interviews leading experts in the paranormal field, takes your calls, and answers your questions on
Positively Psychic.
Hello, welcome to Positively Psychic. This is Mark Christopher Nelson. I can't even speak tonight. And I'm here with my psychic spouse, Barbara Nelson. Say hey, Barb.
Hello, everybody.
Tonight we have a very special show, and we've also got a little delay on our feedback in the mic, which is why I'm speaking as if I'm drunk.
No.
Oh, I'm not. Believe me. Some nights maybe, but not tonight. Tonight we have some terrific guests. We've got author Karen Fraser of the book Avalanche of Spirits, The Ghosts of Wellington. And with her tonight are Bert and Jamie Coates, who are investigators and founders of Northwest Paranormal Investigation Agency. Hello, everybody.
Are Hello.
Hey.
Okay, Bert, you sound great.
Thank you.
Barb, I think we may have a mic open because I'm getting a loop in my headphones. So we'll try to fix that. That's why I sound like all of a sudden I'm falling. Anyway, well, guys, thank you for being with us tonight. We have a great show having the three of you on. I have to tell you that the book was a great read. Again, the title is Avalanche of Spirits, Ghosts of Wellington. And it's the story of a tragedy that took place in Washington State. Karen, can you tell us a little bit about it?
About the tragedy?
Yes, please.
Yeah. Basically, it's the worst avalanche disaster in the history of human lives lost in the history of the United States. And I didn't know about it until I was talking with someone about it. And I live in Washington State. So essentially what happened is that there were two trains that were sitting on passing tracks in this little tiny town of Wellington, Washington, in the Cascade Mountains of Washington State. And there was a snowstorm that dumped about a foot of snow an hour at times for 9 days. And the people on the trains sat and watched as the snow dumped and got increasingly worried because they were sitting below a big slope. And they were worried that an avalanche was going to come down. And ultimately, that's exactly what happened. An avalanche came down and it killed 96 people.
Can you tell us where that was again? I mean, you said a foot an hour for 9 days?
Up to a foot an hour for 9 days. It snowed for 9 days. Yeah, it's in Washington State's Cascade Mountains. And it was one of the worst snowstorms that they've ever had up there. It was actually three storms, one after the other, three fronts that rolled in one after the other. And it was in late February and early March. And it just dumped a tremendous amount of snow.
Wow. Well, and so the thing that I find really interesting is that the three of you guys, you and your teams, actually went up there and were in a place that, I mean, it's a really unusual location. That's one of the things that drew me to your story, is that so often most investigations take place in an urban setting or a suburban setting. This is like the first wilderness investigation that I've had a chance to speak to anybody about. Bert and Jamie, are you there?
We are here.
Hey, hi guys. Hi, Jamie. Nice to speak with you.
Hi.
How did you guys? Who started? Who was the first one to tell who about this location? Karen, did you hear about it first, or Bert and Jamie? How did you guys all get up there?
It's all Bert and Jamie.
Well, what drew you to the story, and what drew you to the location?
You know, I was on the internet and I was looking for a place to to hike somewhere near the house, and we ran across the Iron Goat Trail. So I got off of work early one day, and I decided, oh, this would be kind of cool to do. So I jumped in the Jeep and drove up there and started hiking the trail by myself while Jamie was at work. And, I don't know. It's a beautiful trail, and it has lots of old artifact things. And it's in the middle of the woods, so it's sort of like Life After People, that show on Discovery. So it was really interesting. Came home, did a little bit of research on it, come to find out that there was a terrible avalanche that had happened and killed 96 people, and the rest is kind of history.
Well, your first impression was I need to go up there and look and see what's there. And based on the story, I mean, that is an enormously active place, and it's just unusual to me that you would find all of that activity out way out. Can you give people a general idea about where the former town of Wellington is and where this investigation took place?
The town is in the Cascade foothills in Washington State. It sits in between two mountains in sort of like a bowl area. And Karen, do you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, the reason that the town was there was because of the railroad. It existed to support the railroad, and in particular, the Cascade Tunnel, which is how they got the trains from the eastern slope of the mountains to the western slope of the mountains. So Wellington sat on the western side of this 2.5-mile-long tunnel. So that's why the town was where it is. There's nothing there now. I mean, there's a trail and there's a snow shed and some crumbling foundations and things, but it's gone back to nature. It's like what Bert said. It's very much like that show, Life After People.
Well, it's not Ghosts After People. That's, I mean, well, actually it is, but I mean, it's it's really something else. Also, too, I have to tell everybody, and read, by the way, it's a great book. I highly recommend you pick it up. It's not a super long read, but Karen is able to paint some wonderful pictures and imagery of the situation. But one of the things that you guys faced in this, and I have to go right to it, is the fact that you're out in a place where there are bears, where there are mountain lions, and that if you smell something that smells like cat urine, you better be packing.
Yeah. We learned very quickly, I think, the first or second year of hiking that trail, that you really need to protect yourself. A few guys from work and I hiked the trail, and we ran into a bear. And the only thing that we had on us was maybe a 2-inch pocket knife.
And, so the bear was scared is what you're trying to say.
Exactly.
That's like a toothpick.
So here we are face to face with this bear, and I'm thinking, geez, I've never seen one of these in the wilderness before. This is so great. And somebody had mentioned that it was cub season, and hopefully the cubs were near. And that's when it hit me, you know, for my own protection, along with all the investigators. I think it would be a good idea to have somebody pack in heat, or at least something that'll, if a bear was to attack, which is very rare, or a cougar, or even a person, because you are in the middle of the wilderness, and we've met strange people up there before, you know, we need to be armed.
It's not the ghost that you should be afraid of up there.
Right.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, yeah. So, I can only imagine. I'm used to being in places where, are there gang members? We've been investigating certain parts of Los Angeles. We're going to talk about that a little bit later tonight. But where I'm more worried about drive-by shootings than bears coming up and saying, hey, you look tasty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. Jamie and I last year camped up there for a night, and we woke up. And now when I wake up in a fog, and it takes me about a good 3 hours to actually come to. And there I was sitting on a rock, and she unzips the tent, peeks her head out, and she goes, bear. And, of course, I'm not paying attention, and I'm looking at the sky, and I'm like, oh, it's going to be such a beautiful day. And I hear her go, bear. And I said, what'd you say? She said, bear. And in front of us was a black bear. And I thought, oh, you know, and you don't go for the whole idea of grabbing your gun and protecting yourself. You're just amazed at the beauty of nature and, you know, the animal that's there. sometimes you forget how dangerous they can be.
You see, Bert, that would be a difference between you and I. I would be reaching for the gun or the bear spray or the gun and the bear spray and the nuclear weapon as fast as I probably could.
Yeah, yeah. Jamie's really good with stuff like this. I just kind of look at him and I stare and go, wow, I wonder what color eyes that bear has. She's, you know, she's got the AK-47 and the rocket launcher and she's protecting me.
I couldn't find the nuclear weapon, unfortunately.
Well, Bert and I had the one time when we were walking down the snow shed, and I said, I smell cat urine, and Bert said, yeah, so do I, and it took us a couple of minutes for it to sink in that there was rustling in the bushes, and we smelled cat urine, and that might not be a good thing, so.
No, when you're not at the top of the food chain in a particular place, it's very good to smell, pay attention to the scents and aromas around you.
Yeah, Jamie ran into a cougar down at the debris site with some other investigators. And, you know, they handle themselves so well when there's danger involved. I mean, we're not talking like the six shooters come out and it's okay corral thing. They've been trained, and they do really well.
When you say debris site, do you want to elaborate? And then we'll go. This is just kind of an unusual. This is the only investigation I know where I've had a chance to talk to people, Barb and I, where you're literally packing. But when you say debris site, what is it that you're referring to?
The debris site's actually where when the train got hit by the snowslide, it went down about 150 foot ravine. And it's where the train ended up. There's no actual trail or anything down there, so you kind of have to work your way downhill. So last year, we've never actually done an investigation down there, so last year I took about four or five people, investigators down there, and we tried to do an investigation down there, and it was quite dark, and then we ran into the cougar down there, so didn't quite work out as planned.
Well, I'm just glad that we have all three of you and a couple of your friends still with us then.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, me too.
I wasn't there for that. I heard about it, but I wasn't there. I think we were there that night, but...
Yeah, you guys were up in the snow shed with me. And yeah. It's down there, you know, wrestling with the tiger or cougar or whatever it was.
But it's a good spot for potential activity, so I'd like to get back down there this year and with more of my Army crew and go down there and do another investigation.
Are there any remnants of the train left up there?
Oh, yes. Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow, that'd be something to see. So I've taken this kind of a little bit off of it because I'm just kind of like going, wow, these are like frontier ghost hunting.
Ghost hunters with guns.
Ghost hunters with guns, yeah. I mean, you guys could close the loop real quick. If you're not paying attention, you get to be, you know, we could go and investigate you next time.
Yeah, no kidding.
Well, at least you'd have friends.
Yeah.
That's right.
You wouldn't have to take it that long, awkward, getting to know the neighbors thing.
No. Oh. No. It'd be like, oh, finally, you got here.
Yeah, we've been waiting.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, how funny. Well, you guys, there's so much that I want to talk about and want to get to. What Barb and I both, Barbara's looked at the book and I've read it, and that there's so much activity, a lot of touching, a lot of voice phenomena, a lot of direct response to questions. I always used to think that it helped to go to a location where the ghosts were used to human interaction or dealing with hunters. And clearly this wouldn't be the case. They're fairly, I would guess, there haven't been a lot of investigations in the area. So the idea that they seem capable of conversing with you rather quickly and easily is kind of interesting to me.
Yeah, it's interesting too.
Go ahead, Bert.
No, I was done. Go ahead, Karen.
I say Bert and Jamie have been going up there for about 5 years now with their team. Yeah. So, and as people have become more aware of this Wellington site, there are certainly groups that go through there now other than Bert and Jamie's group.
Yeah.
Well, even still, I mean, well, that begs the question, have you seen a difference in activity from your first contacts to more recent?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. When we first started investigating the area, it was real It was very quiet. There wasn't a lot of stuff happening. But as the years went on, more and more things would happen. It's sort of like our theory is somebody next door moves in, you kind of get to know them a little bit, and then pretty soon, you know, you're feeding their cat while they're on vacation. You know, that's sort of like the ghosts up at Wellington. You know, it's my belief that you bond a friendship with whoever it is up there, or the guys up there.
It seems like the more comfortable that we get with them, the more comfortable they're getting with us. And every year, I think that's possibly why we're getting more and more activity, because now we look at them as our friends. I mean, we go up and visit with them and try and hold conversations with them. And, you know, and most of the time we do get responses, which is quite nice.
Well, one thing, too, there in the book you talk about, I guess there were a number of Italian immigrants that had worked on the trail, and that so you're pretty sure that they were there and able to speak in Italian.
Karen has some stuff, don't you, from...
Actually, what I have is... we had some things happen. I learned a little bit of Italian because that was one of my theories, and I think it's been one of your theories as well, hasn't it, Bert, that maybe some of them up there are Italian.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and so one of the things I do have is we used a little, it's called a talker box, and it's made by Digital Dowsing. It's actually a kit that you buy and then you build it. And it's like the Ovilus kind of, except that it uses the sounds instead of words. The Ovilus uses words, and this instead uses, I think they're called allophones, the different sounds of language, like ah, ee, oh, oo, oo, and there's a bunch of them. And so my son was walking through and he was carrying this and he had a recorder and he said, "Are you Italian?" And this talker box said, "Not Italian." And so I do have that. But we've had some sort of response to things when we've called out in Italian or used some more Italian types things. Like I know that Latin Mass is in Latin, but one night we were there and Jim was calling out Latin Mass. Like he was actually calling out the Latin Mass from the Monty Python movie, you know, except that he wasn't whacking himself in the head. And so Jim is my husband. And so he was calling out this Latin Mass. And first, one of the kids that was with us, Matthew, got, I can't remember, I think he got like whacked in the head or something. And then a minute later, Tanner jumped sky high because something had grabbed his leg.
Tanner is your son?
Oh, Tanner. Yeah, Tanner is my son and Matthew is his buddy. We've gone up with our kids and their friends a few times.
Oh, and how do they feel about that? I mean, do they think mom and dad are a little bit whack? Or are they pretty cool with what you guys are doing?
They think it's pretty cool. And what I really have been impressed with them is that they're very calm about it. They're not afraid. And I think that you'll find a lot of adults who are afraid, but the kids aren't. They're pretty accepting of it. And since we believe that there are kids up at this site, they seem to respond very well to children that come up.
Well, Barbara and I have had experiences on the Queen Mary where there's in the pool area, it's pretty well known that there's a little girl down there named Jackie. And we happened to be there on an evening when the security guards were there, joined us, and then the security guards' daughters joined us. And the guards were certainly, I mean, the children were certainly not that different in age than certainly the little girl who had passed on, the ghost. And Barbara and I were both saying, well, do you like talking to, do you like having a little girl? And Barbara had an EMF meter, and it was just like, you know, lighting up like a Christmas tree, and it was just moving, going, and I felt very much, it's like, yes, I almost felt like someone was tugging on my hands. Yes, I like this. So
yeah.
So I bet they didn't actually react real well to having the children with you.
Yeah, well, and I've gotten a lot of EVPs in response to things that the kids have said and done in this little voice that I seem to get a lot, which is kind of this high-pitched, almost like a Yoda voice. So, but it sounds like a child.
Well, you have in the book, you talk about how you get to know through your research which children probably passed during the avalanche, and that you actually think that you've made contact with some of them, including Leonard. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, I hadn't. Well, first of all, I wasn't aware, but Bert and Jamie and their team, Northwest Paranormal Investigation Agency, had actually captured two things that seemed to indicate that there was a child up there. And one of them is a video of a little shadowy white figure about child size peeking out from behind one of the support poles of the snow shed that is at the site. And then the other one is a child's voice calling out. Heard it at the time, didn't you, Jamie?
Can you say that again? We had a little a Skype-ish glitch there.
Okay. Well, excuse me. Bert and Jamie captured a child's voice calling out mama, and I think it was disembodied, wasn't it, Jamie?
That's right.
Yeah, that was disembodied.
That's got to be kind of heartbreaking in certain respects. Have you brought psychics up there that have been able to maybe help these kids, these child spirits?
Well, I had a real issue with the child spirits, children spirits up there for quite some time. And actually, one of the nights that we were up there, Bert sort of said something to me about it, because I'm not the first person who's gone up there and connected with this child spirit and sort of felt really bad about it. And so what was it that you told me, Bert? Do you remember?
Yeah, we tell our investigators the same thing. You have to be careful when you interact with ghosts or spirits of children, because especially women we find get real attached with that. They get real emotional, and you cannot get emotional with something that's dead. It's no good for you, and we don't know if we're doing them any favors by trying to protect them or telling them to do things, because we're not dead and we don't know. So we always tell the investigators, don't get attached if you start interacting with the ghost of a child. It's best just to kind of do your job, do the best you can, and then let it go.
Mm-hmm. So how many of these spirits are residual energies, or how many are real intelligent spirit?
Just real quick, I don't hold a lot of water to the residual theories and what's intelligent. I think it's good that people, tag certain things with certain names, but who's to say that it's residual and who's to say it's not? A lot of things that happen up there can go one way or they can go another. And I think that we need to step outside of that box, and we need to start thinking of things differently and just accept them for what they are, if that made any sense at all.
No, I understand. I understand your point.
And we've been going up there for so many years. As far as the residual theories go, I mean, we haven't really seen the same types of activity going on. I mean, it's my own personal belief that it is intelligent, because they do respond to our questions, and I personally feel that they are trying to communicate with us in a way that, and we're trying to find that middle ground to where we can actually, hopefully, someday be able to successfully communicate with amongst each other.
Well, you guys from in the book, you seem to be able to ask a series of questions, and I have to tell you, my first impressions were that they were not too keen on having you there.
No, I wouldn't. I don't know. It's sort of like somebody invading your home, you just got to get to know them. They got to get to know you, and I don't know.
Well, I think one of the things that's so unique about this whole situation at Wellington is that what Bert and Jamie and their team have done is they've actually built a relationship with ghosts. And I think a lot of teams don't necessarily do that. They go from one place to the next place to the next place. And certainly NWPIA investigates other places other than Wellington. But Wellington, they're up there a lot when they can get up there, weather permitting, of course. And so they've been able to build a relationship. And I think that's part of why the story was so unique for me, was this relationship that they've worked for 5 years on building with these ghosts. And I think that it has something to contribute to the field when you can have a group of people build a relationship with a group of ghosts, as opposed to people just sort of going in and, you know, taking some readings and documenting it. So it lends itself to some rather unique research opportunities, I think.
Mm-hmm. And, I just had a quick question about why do you feel that these souls are still staying there, whether they're trapped there or want to be there? Why do you think that they're still hanging around there?
For me, it's a beautiful place. It's a place that holds a lot of history. It's very quiet. And it's a very peaceful place. If I was to die, I would go on vacation to Wellington. That's how beautiful it is.
Wow.
And, you know, you have the animals, you have the sunshine, you have the warmth, you have the snow, you have all these wonderful things all around you. I mean, you are nature when you enter that place. I don't want to sound really hippie-ish here, but when you get in there, you are a part of the wilderness. It's awesome. And I think that's why they return. It was part of their lives, and I would want to return just to hang out.
Do they know that they're dead?
Yeah, I think that most ghosts know that they're dead. When I die, I'll come back and let you know. But I think they know.
I mean, I've always wondered if it's kind of a dimensional thing, whether they're looking at us and saying, hey, what are you doing here? I mean, I think that there are some spirits that clearly are reacting to, like, hey, they're here. What are we going to do about it? Or how are we going to react with them? And then I think there's also spirits that seem to interact in, like, less understandable ways. You know, they'll say things. I mean, when they're answering questions, clearly there's a connection. There's a crossover. But there are other times when it seems a little bit confused what they say in return.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel exactly the same way, because, I mean, I've been up at Wellington before and with just one other investigator, and clearly something came right up to my ear and asked me, what are you doing?
Yes, why are you here?
I was startled. I was like, well, I'm here to visit you.
Yeah.
Well, and you guys had that, oh, look, the scientists are back, EVP, too. So they obviously know that somebody's up there doing something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Scientists, they refer to as the scientists.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, going back to, like, the 1910 thinking, obviously there wasn't paranormal investigators back then, so maybe that was the only word that they could come up with what we were doing with the equipment that we have or something.
Yeah.
Well, that makes great sense, though. I mean, it does. You know, if you think about the context. You told me, too, that you were doing some research into that time period as to how the children were dressed, what you were seeing. And mm-hmm. It seemed that the things that you, the spirits you were seeing dressed in a way that made sense for the time.
Well, No Face certainly is, isn't he? I haven't seen No Face, but Jamie has.
And Kenny has, too. And yeah. He's dressed to that time period, 1910.
Who's No Face, before we go any further? Because I don't know if I'd like to meet someone with No Face.
I saw that. I saw that in one of the videos. The girl said that it was a white face and it had no eyes.
That was Jamie. Yeah.
Oh, okay, Jamie. Yeah, I saw that in that video.
I was a little stunned at the time, and I think we refer to No Face only because last year or the year before, I had seen him, another investigator had seen him, and we both kind of described him as having no face. I mean, it's like this white cotton ball that does make a face figure, but there's no real definite features, like no eyeball features, no nose features or anything, and so we just
somebody said No Face, and that's he got tagged No Face.
Yeah, so we ran with it.
We've repeatedly asked him his name and he won't tell us. So.
Well, have you had other spirits tell you who they are?
Sergey. Sergey.
Yeah. We have an EVP of the Sergei, remember?
That's right. I remember
that. Yeah.
So we have one, but they've never come out and they've said, my name is, you know, fill in the blank. But and we're hoping for that soon.
Yeah, there's a lot of new stuff we want to try up there to
get
them to say their name.
But, you know, throughout all this research, and Karen can contest to this, all the research that we've been doing up there and the different things that we've been trying, we don't want to offend them. So we're really, you know, we're treading very lightly. Every year when we go in there, and Karen was with us on the 100 year, we announce ourselves. We say, well, in a nice way, we say, hey, we're back. You know, brought some folks up here with us, some friends of ours, and we want to try a couple of different things. And we explain it and then move on with it quickly. So... But we haven't got any bad responses yet.
Well, when you think about it, that's really hallowed ground. I mean, 90 people died there, and
it is.
You don't want to make light of it, and you don't want to abuse that privilege of being there with them. And you know, it's I think you're handling it very respectfully.
Oh, definitely. They've become our friends. I don't know if you could have ghosts as friends. I know if we had a party, there wouldn't be a lot of money spent on food. But they become part of our lives, and when we have to leave for the season, we're just devastated because it's like leaving grandma's house.
Well, it has to be really fascinating. And you know, another thing, too, that I've experienced is I think sometimes ghosts can look into your minds and look into your head. I mean, I don't think they have to sit and wait and wonder what you're going to say next. I think that there are some spirits that are able and capable of reading your mind. Have you had that kind of experience? Because I would think that they're all about nonverbal communication. They don't need to have mouths to communicate, so why do they have to, you know, have ears to listen?
I think if they were to look into my mind, it would take a nanosecond to...
I doubt that. You guys have done some fascinating work. And by the way, the site is... Can you tell people about it in case our listeners want to check it out?
Sure. It's nwpia.com. And everything... Wellington has its own little button, so you click on that, and of course it has subfolders of the investigations we've done and some of the things that we tried and videos and stuff like that. So
and historical photos, which are really interesting because there are photos that they have on their site that were taken right after the avalanche of the wreckage of these trains and some of the bodies wrapped and on sleds being pulled out of the site and that type of thing.
Do you think that perhaps maybe all of the bodies were not taken out? What might that be a reason for some of them staying?
I think all the bodies were removed, right?
Well, there is a theory that some bodies might have melted through the snow and washed down the river, which is why the death toll is not totally set in stone. They don't know for sure that it was 96 people, but that's a pretty close estimate.
Yeah,
and they didn't find the last body until July.
Yeah, I don't. That's a good question. I don't know.
Well, I'd have to think that they, you know, maybe there was a couple of people that didn't know, but just to have a disaster of that speed, too. I mean, dying in an avalanche would be kind of a strange way to go. I mean, any death, any tragedy like that would be shocking. But I tend to think that all of these people weren't like the night before they were planning on, they were kind of having a little party. It's like, oh, we're going, this is great.
Yep.
They were celebrating. Then to have that sudden and drastic and terrible turn of events, maybe some of them were confused.
Go ahead, Bert.
Sorry, Karen. One of the things that we read in a book, it's called Vis Major from Martin Burwash. O'Neill's cook, and
wait, who's O'Neill?
Oh, sorry, O'Neill was the superintendent of the railroad at the time, so he was in charge of everyone. And O'Neill was a very intelligent person. He was very strong, but he did leave the night of the avalanche. He had hiked out and he went to the town of Help me out here, Karen.
Scenic.
Hey, scenic. Scenic. His cook stayed behind in his own private car. And then his train master stayed in the same car as the cook. When the avalanche had hit, it, of course, killed him. But the description of what they look like when they found him is pretty shocking.
They saw it coming.
Yeah, they saw it. It was almost like they were clawing to stay alive. You know, the grim faces of death, of dying, the scared, you know, look on their face. I mean, it's one of those things where you have to imagine what it would be like to be covered with 40 feet of snow. And you can't breathe. Snow is continuously entering your mouth. I mean, it would be a horrific death. Terrible. So he describes that in the book to a T. And to me, that was really touching. I mean, that brought a lot of light to what kind of we were doing and what a painful death it was to all of them.
It must have been rapid, too, but I don't want to dwell too much on that one last moment. One of the things that I guess through all of your research, and Karen and Bert and Jamie, is that you learned a lot about the people themselves. You're able to put meat on the bones, put faces and stories around these people at the time of their passing, and that's the thing that kind of got to me quite a bit, frankly.
Yeah, Karen's good at that.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, there are stories that what some of these people endured that I honestly can't tell without feeling a lot of strong emotion about it. I was doing a show for the Travel Channel. They're doing a little thing on a show about Wellington, and they needed somebody to talk about it. And I started to tell this story of this mother who felt her child smother underneath her while they were buried, and she knew that when he stopped moving, he had died. It was her infant son. And this is actually the first time I think I've gotten through speaking about it without bursting into tears. So
terrible, terrible tragedy. And then just all of the stories about people who were on their way to here and on their way to there. I mean, they were living full lives. They were cut down in the middle of doing so many things.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I bring it up just at the idea that they weren't done living, many of them. And that fact that they all probably kind of came to the realization that they are still there after the avalanche, maybe the fact that there's so many, there's a community there, maybe that's holding them there. Maybe it doesn't seem so strange because they're surrounded by so many people, so many other beings, so many other consciousnesses, if I got that right, that would kind of enforce or encourage or support them.
Well, I think the town is still alive in very many ways. One of the things that happens up at Wellington, and I have only heard little teeny tiny bits of this, but there's a party that starts up, and maybe Bert and Jamie, you could describe that, because that's a pretty regular phenomenon.
Yeah, it's like a barn party. I don't know if anybody's been to a barn party, but it's definitely like a musical instruments like the harmonica and violin, you know, and you start hearing these things and you're thinking, oh, you know, my mind's playing a trick on me. You have running water nearby, mm-hmm. But it's very real. It's
because usually when it does start up and we'll all be quietly sitting around investigating, you'll see, you know, four or five of our investigators' heads pop up and we all start looking at each other like, you know, kind of having that eye contact communication going on, like, do you hear that? You know, and then everybody will kind of nod their head, and it's like listening to a party going on in the background that's very clear.
Yeah, it's weird. It's one of the strangest things I've ever heard.
Well, I believe you. I mean, it's just the idea that, you know, there's so many people there, so many spirits there, and then the night before they all perished. They were having a party. They were kind of like, oh, boy, we get to get on with our lives.
Yeah.
Well, remember, there was a town there, too. This was a small town, maybe, between 1 and 200 people, probably, in the town. But there was a town there as well. And I would not be surprised if some of the people that haunt Wellington, that stay at Wellington, are people who lived in that town, because that town had a rather unceremonious end. It was this little town and these people who struggled under the harshest of conditions to build a life in this mountainous town. And then after the avalanche, the town was renamed immediately. It was renamed Ty, and within 20 years, the town was completely gone because they'd moved the railroad further down the hill.
Yeah.
It's just an overwhelming thing. Well, on your site, I mean, I've been there too, and I've seen some of the photos. They're really startling. Like, there's images where there's this one where it looks like a fire or like a blur of spirit that looks like a daytime apparition where it blurs the people out behind them. And I think someone is standing. I can't remember exactly, but you have some great visuals and some pretty impactful stuff. Can you tell us about some of the things that stand out for you?
Well, what you're talking about is Shane's picture. Shane, he captured that picture during, I think, his first investigation at Wellington. I could be wrong, but yeah. And at the same time, one of his teammates, Joe Heitha, also got an EVP that went along with the picture. They were captured almost simultaneously, because in this EVP, you hear Shane saying something about the camera. And then you hear a snap, and you hear like just this babble of voices all going on together. And then there's a loud whisper that says, "Let's get out, avalanche."
Let's get out, avalanche.
And that's what I interpret it to say. That's what it sounds like to me. But you can hear the word avalanche very clearly.
It just makes you wonder, I mean, how much time could they have had to react? How many people were there? Were there survivors of this incident?
Yes. Yes, there were a number of survivors.
Hundreds?
No.
I don't know.
30?
Yeah.
It's just, that's really heartbreaking. Well, one area that you guys seem to at first have some trepidations about was Area 61. What can you tell us about that? And also, I'm used to when you go into a place, it's like, okay, Barbara and I were just at a hospital where we could go, and we were in a prison, you know, where we can tell you this is where we are. When you guys are investigating, where are you? You've talked about a snow shed, and you've talked about a debris area. But where are you when you're actually picking up these spirits?
When I investigate, I'm often la-la land somewhere most of the time. I'm trying to figure things out in my head as they happen. And I kind of go blank, you know, until something happens, and then it's, you know, game on. But, I try not to dwell too much on the pain, I guess, that happens, but more, I don't know, kind of what's going on around us. Because there are, when you're investigating outside, it's really weird, but you have the wind and the rain, you have all these natural things that are happening, and you have to kind of keep that in mind, too. So you'll hear a snap or a crack in the bushes somewhere, or a tree limb snapping off, and the first thing you think is animal. You know?
Yeah.
You know, that was an animal. You know, everybody needs to group together and start thinking smart. But personally, I'm kind of off somewhere.
I would probably say that 90% of our investigations is done in the snow shed.
Yeah.
And what is that like? How big of a space? And is that where Area 61 is?
Yes. It is, what, half a mile long?
Yeah.
It's a half mile long, and it's really tall. It's a huge structure. And so what they have done, Northwest Paranormal Investigation Agency has done, is they've actually numbered some of the poles. And so they can sort of, I mean, you can mark your space by, you know, there's little bridges or bridge-like things that run through the snow shed. And so that's one of the ways that you can mark your spaces. And there are just little things that you can landmark with. So Area 61 actually is a pole that has a Day Glow 61 painted on it. I don't think you guys did that. I think that was just graffiti, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, yeah. After you've been up there the gazillion times, you memorize the graffiti on the wall.
Yeah. Or the water spots, or, you know, yeah. Hey, this is where the water spot looks like the Virgin Mary. And this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the beginning. Yeah, well, she's picking her nose, though. That's what.
Yeah. Yeah, and then there's the face in the pole, and I mean, so there are things that you sort of learn to mark your space. Plus, you just have a sense once you've walked through the snow shed repeatedly, you kind of know where you are. So,
you know, sorry, Karen. It doesn't just happen during the 9 hours. It happens during the day too. We were hiking with Jim and Karen. We had gone to Windy Point, which is about, I don't know, a mile away from where the snow shed is.
And that's 2.5 miles.
Okay. And that's
where why we were so tired.
That's right. My legs were burning. I don't know about yours. But they would run the bodies down this this really steep hill into another town on sleds. So we're there, we're hiking back, we're inside the snow shed, we're talking very quietly, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, we start hearing something. And it was like somebody was trying to talk to us. And it was funny, because talk about three people stopping very closely, or very quickly in their tracks. Yeah. It was Jamie, Karen, and I, and we were like, argh! And of course, Jim's moving along.
Jim was oblivious, yeah.
Which is funny, because usually I'm the one that's fully oblivious of what's going on, but... it was so cool to hear that. It was weird. It was like, it's hard to explain.
Well, and we had stopped on the way out and left toys behind what we call the child pole, where Bert and Jamie captured this little child peeking out from behind the pole. And so we left a stuffed animal and a ball there, I think, as we hiked out to Windy Point. And it sounded to me like a child saying something to us as we were headed back.
Absolutely.
Like they have just discovered their new little toys.
Yeah, or they were saying thank you or something. Yeah.
Something. It was very excited. It was a very excited voice. And those are the kind of things that we get really excited about. You know, they're communicating with us, whether they're saying thank you or they're saying, you know, go away.
Or next time bring a teddy bear, not a bunny, or, you know.
Exactly. We just really get excited because that's sort of an acceptance. You know, you're here, we see you, and this is what we have to say. So we get excited, and of course we run home and we grab the gear and we run all the way back and we say, okay, we're back again.
Well, don't you think, too, the fact that you are aware of them, you are trying to interact with them in a polite and thoughtful and considerate way. Imagine, put yourself in their shoes if they had feet. And say to yourself, it's like, okay, someone finally notices us.
Right.
What a revelation that would be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so they probably are very glad to see you as well. I mean, think about, you know, if you feel a little isolated, we all go through times where you're housebound or something.
Or they haven't forgotten.
Or that you haven't, I mean, Barbara brings up a good point that, They haven't been forgotten.
We try to tell as many people as we possibly can about Wellington and bring light to what, not the tragedy that had happened, but more of what the lifestyle was like and how wonderful people were.
And actually, the 100-year anniversary wasn't that long ago, was it? It was March 1st?
Yes. That's right.
We were there.
We were there.
We were there.
And we were cold.
We were cold. I'm looking at the back of the book. Again, for all that, everyone listening, Avalanche of Spirits, The Ghosts of Wellington. On the back of the book, you see this train that is largely obscured in snow as it goes by.
Yep.
Yep. And the front of the book, the front cover, is actually one of Jamie's photographs of the road into Wellington.
That's beautiful. I love it. I love
it.
I had another question. 1910, that wasn't too long ago, 100 years. Are there any relatives that you have gotten in contact with, or, you know, cousins, uncles, aunts?
I haven't. Karen, have you?
You know, interestingly, this is just part of part of what's been so interesting to Wellington about me is how drawn I've been to the story, and how drawn Bert and Jamie are to the location. And we seem to run across a lot of people who are just as drawn to this location as we are. I hear from people occasionally. As a matter of fact, I'm having lunch with a guy tomorrow. It's the guy who shined the light at us when we were there on the anniversary, Bert.
Oh, really?
But oh. I'm having lunch with him tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Oh, but any. So there are these people that we hear from that are just as equally drawn. But anyway, I say that so I can tell you this. I worked with the guy, and then I left my job. I haven't been with my job for a little over a year now. But he was new to the company, and I just happened to, after I left, in the summer last year, I emailed him because he has some experience as a filmmaker. So I was asking him some questions, and I told him what we were looking at doing this film about, and which was Wellington, and he said, oh, my aunt lived in Thai, which was what Wellington was named after. So just, you know, this, and so I said, oh my gosh, can I talk to her? And he said, no, she died last year. But so they're kind of little interesting connections to the place that you can find if you look.
Well, if anyone listening tonight has a relative or has any connection to this town and has a story to share, where can they contact you, Karen?
They can email me, Karen Frazier, FRAZIER, at paranormalunderground.net.
By the way, I love your site, and Karen also has a magazine, Paranormal Underground Magazine.
Yes. Yes, I'm one of the editors of the magazine, and I'm a journalist for the magazine as well. And that's actually, it was in that capacity that I first heard about Wellington.
How did you find out about these two pioneer ghost hunters?
I first went up there on July 11th of last year, and I was taken up by the group that I was telling you about who had this photograph and the EVP, a part of Washington. They were kind enough to take me up there, and Bert and Jamie were up there because they're always there. Yeah. And so I was really fascinated to meet them and talk to them. And as I started to get to know what they do and what they go through to get into Wellington as early as they can, and how much time they spend up there, it seemed to mirror the connection that I was feeling to the place and sort of the drive that I have to go up there. It's 3.5 hours from our house, and I'll be up there as often as I can this summer, and I was last year as well. And so I just, because they seemed to feel about Wellington what I sort of felt like maybe I was going to feel about Wellington too, I was really interested in talking to them and getting to know them.
Well, Barb brought up a good point about maybe you or maybe Bert and Jamie. I wonder if you were some of the spirits that passed there.
Could have been. I don't know. Karen, you're...
My theory.
Your
well,
theory.
Yeah, that's... I had a psychic reading for an article I was doing for the magazine here just last month with a psychic medium named Jennifer Hicks. And it was really interesting because in the reading, where I was expecting to hear from my dead grandmother and, you know, my dead uncle and all of that type of thing, what I heard from were all of these spirits at Wellington. Wow. And one of the things she said in the reading is, you were there. And I have long had a theory about Bert, only because if you put a picture of Bert next to a picture of Superintendent James O'Neill, they look a lot alike.
Wow, that's interesting.
It is. And Bert's very protective of the site of Wellington. And James O'Neill, I would think, would be carrying around a lot. You know, this happened on his watch.
Yeah.
And he couldn't prevent it.
Well, I mean, both of you, I mean, O'Neill was probably trying to do the right thing. And it certainly sounds like, Bert, that you are too.
We're trying. And just real quick, you know, other teams do show up and we get out of the way. It's not like we hoard the place and say, oh,
yeah.
Oh, this is
ours.
Right. when teams come in, we immediately leave the area and say, hey, how long, you know, we can come back tomorrow if you want us to, or, you know, we want to share this with you, and we don't want to be hovering over your shoulder saying, okay, don't say that. That's the wrong thing to say.
Right.
I'm all in the speech with ghosts. So, except for the, you know, the gorilla ghost hunter that screams and yells, I don't know, not too keen about that, but, you know, whatever. And so we just want to make sure that everybody understands that we don't hoard the place. Other teams come in and we get out of their way and we'll be there for security and that's all.
And I think it's an advantage to other teams to have you guys there because you do have so much knowledge and understanding and you can provide some verification. So if they have an experience and they say, hey, I just had this experience in this place, you can say, well, that's sort of consistent with what goes on there.
It actually would be pretty valuable to have someone that you could ask for questions about or to get advice, especially in a place that has so many physical challenges such as that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the only thing that we do ask of other groups that do go up there and investigate is to be respectful. You know, we would hate to see anybody going up there and doing some unwanted provoking or something and, you know, make them upset. So that's the only thing that we do ask is that other people are respectful of the area that they're in.
Well, if someone wanted to go up there, could they contact you to perhaps participate? I mean, would you lead other people up there for excursions or investigations?
Funny you should ask.
Yeah, funny thing. absolutely. We're doing tours up there this summer. Whoever wants to go up there with us, and we... It's an open investigation. In other words, we don't sit there and say, no, that's not the right way of doing things. You have to do it this way. This is we leave everybody alone. If they have questions, we'll answer them. We'll give them a bit of the history. But other than that, they're kind of on their own to experience what we experienced in the very beginning, which is really kind of what it's all about.
Well, I would think that, again, being I'm used to going to a place where I can say, okay, we went there, Barbara and I, yeah. We'll go to a location, and we drive home. There must be some particularly interesting things that people need to know to get in there.
Yeah.
Google Earth.
Google Earth.
That's why we give the guided tour. We'll meet them in a spot. It's a difficult place to get into sometimes, depending on the weather. You know, we're there just to guide them through as a tour.
I was going to ask you, what went on in your very first initial trip up there, your very first trip?
Very first trip was with Jamie and myself, another guy that helped us start NWPIA, and his six kids. And we saw these tiny little, they look like mice, jumping across the parking lot. It was, once again, something I've never seen before, but I don't want to use the word orbs, but they were round, and they were very bright, glowing balls of light, and it was like they were skipping across the parking lot, and I was like, whoa, that was cool.
And we didn't even go into the snow shed. That was just in the parking lot
right.
of Wellington.
And that was within the first maybe 30 minutes of being there. So we focused a lot on the parking lot because that's where a lot of the activity had started for us. It wasn't until later on when we ventured into the dark snow shed. So that was the first thing that happened.
Well, that's a pretty good start, frankly.
Yeah, I dug it.
Apparently.
Oh, and the saying, that's right. The next time we had gone up there, we actually heard a woman start singing. And it was like your grandmother when she's cleaning dishes or she's cooking, you know, she kind of starts out with a little hum, and then it gets into a deeper hum, and then it kind of breaks out into a joyful little song, which was really touching because it took me back to when my grandmother used to do that. And it was... Whoa, it was so cool to listen to. And you're set back, you're thinking, oh, my God, I can hear that. And so did Mike, a friend of ours. But it was kind of neat because you're listening to a person's personality. I don't know if that makes sense, but mm-hmm. you could really kind of get a feel for what she was doing. She was very happy at the moment, and she was doing something. I don't know, but she had a beautiful voice.
Isn't that encouraging, though, the idea that, you know, they're just not sitting there suffering? I don't really think that's the case, but if there's room for happiness in their existence, in their consciousness.
Oh, absolutely. And, yeah. You know, when we go up there, we try to be as happy as possible. We don't go in and drill them with 150 questions. We talk to them. We tell them kind of what's going on with our lives.
There's definitely, when you go up to Wellington and you go into the snow shed, you definitely get a strong sense of the vibe that's going on in that night.
Yeah.
I mean, like, there's been times where we've walked in and we're like, oh, something doesn't feel like it's in a good mood tonight. But, you know, 99% of the time when we do go up there, it is a happy feeling.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very social kind of a feeling when we go up there.
Yeah. Sort of walking into a party and seeing all your friends, you know, kind of get that excited feeling that, you know, hey, guys, how you doing? It sounds corny, but...
No, not at all. I mean, Barbara and I go to the Queen Mary fairly regularly. And I think that we have a pretty good feeling about what it's like there. We've been there, I don't know how many times. Not
a lot.
I don't know.
Over the years.
Over the years, what, 6 times or so, something like that? I don't know.
Or more.
More than that, perhaps.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask you guys, I'm trying to picture what actually happened when that event happened. Like, it sounds like the snow hit the train, and the train ended up falling into a ravine.
That's right.
And then where does the snow shed come in? Like, where is that in relation to where the train was?
It's exactly where the train was. They built it after the avalanche to protect trains. They started construction right away, and I believe there's a plaque on the snow shed that says 1916, so my guess is that would be when construction ended, but I don't know that for sure. Do you know the date of when they finished construction?
Yeah, it was a year after the avalanche. I mean, they had to quickly do something because people stopped riding that particular train or riding those tracks because of those avalanches. That's why they had to move the train station quite a ways away, put it on the opposite side of the tracks. They had to rename the town Tide because it's still today. If you ride Amtrak, and as they're telling the story of the Cascade, they will leave out the avalanche of Wellington.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's terrible.
I mean, even though the tracks are now down where the town of Scenic once was, and there's a new tunnel, and trains haven't gone through there since 1929.
That's actually really terrible because it's like they totally want to wipe out that entire event.
That's right. And
yes.
Like those 96 people never really got the recognition, and good thing that Karen actually, you know, got to tell their story.
Right.
Finally.
Yeah, it's good thing Karen knows how to write, because she does a wonderful job at it. If I was to do it, you'd have like 10 pages of blah blah blah.
Now, Bert, stop. Every time you say it, well, I don't know, and I can't write. I'm gonna have to. I mean, we've just talked tonight, but clearly, you've played a big part in telling their story and protecting the location. So, hey, hats off to you for that. And that's
Thank
no
you.
Small task.
Yeah,
Thank you.
I think one of the things that I'm noticing in all these investigations that Mark and I are going on, you know, the message that comes through is that these people come to you and they basically don't want to be forgotten. It's like, remember me. You know, my life mattered when I was here, and I don't want to be forgotten, and I don't want to be remembered totally for this avalanche. I was a good person, and I had a life, and, you know.
Is there anything up there that would commemorate beyond, like, the little plaque is there anything there to commemorate what happened there?
Karen?
Well, there are some signs that, as you walk down the trail, there are a few little signs that sort of tell you a little bit of the story, not a lot. I truly believe that what one of the things the spirits want is they want their story told, and they want this to be commemorated. And one of the things that I would like to do is find a way to put something up there that truly does commemorate them. And it's not something that we've been able to do yet, but it's something that I feel really strongly about that I'd like to be able to do at some point.
Oh, we'll get her done.
Yeah.
Well, that, I have to tell you guys, that would make a pretty good TV episode, show, documentary, something like that.
Huh, really?
I think so, too. Yeah. So what do you think
about
that?
What a crazy idea.
What an idea. Well, you know, we tried last summer and it didn't work out. And I think that it didn't work out because it wasn't supposed to, because it wasn't the time. And hopefully the time is now and we'll be able to get something put together this summer, because what we did get put together from our time last summer, I think was a pretty workmanlike effort. And I think we can do something even better this year.
Well, I happen to, you know, maybe we should talk offline, off the air about, well, bring it up now. What if
visiting.
Maybe we should try to organize a TV show and get it done up there.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like you guys to come. You know that. Every time I've talked to you, I've invited you and said, get up here and we'll head up.
It's true. Yes, you did. And you've been more than sweet and nice about it. And I just keep running into other excuses to talk to you, Karen.
Is it nice up there in the summer? Like, not as hot as it is down here, but...
It's gorgeous.
I mean, absolutely beautiful. Think of, I don't know, a place that you love the most. That Wellington is that place. A lot of people fall in love with it. Karen fell in love with it. We fell in love with it. Oh, and if you guys come up, Mark, you can carry my gun.
I've got a 9mm. I'll keep that on my hip. But
I was going to say you can carry mine. I just got a pink one.
a pink nine.
It's a 38 special.
I was going to say, where would you purchase pink?
I like it already.
I got it at Cabela's. It's really cute. It's a pink little 38 special.
Oh God, I have no idea. I
love it.
You'd send so many mixed signals to be a man carrying a pink handgun.
I don't know. I think.
It's like I'm in touch with my feminine side, and my feminine side is a bitch, and you better be nice.
Yeah, but if anybody, Mark, you could wear it.
I'm not that metrosexual, especially about handguns. No, it's
you look good in pink.
Thanks. Okay, Barbara, it's time for Barbara to go to bed. Well, this is good. I hadn't really thought about talking about pink handguns tonight, so thank you. That's this. What does it come like with a Barbie doll or something like that?
No, but it does come with a pink headband, and you have to wear that too.
Pistol pink.
And leg warmers.
Hey, we have someone in the chat room says they have a .22, a pink rifle.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
I saw those too. Uh huh.
That's cool.
And then there's a pink pink camouflage one too, like a pink digicam or something that I saw.
Pink. I tend to think of pink camouflage as being contradictory.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially digicam.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, you know, clearly, Karen, you're shopping a different department than I would be. So.
I am unabashedly girly. I this last summer, of course, I didn't have a gun, and I was up there with my pink taser, which, you know, Bert would sort of roll his eyes at because it wasn't going to hurt anybody, but hey.
Oh, yeah, it's like, that's like a gnat for a bear. It's like, what is that? Knock that off. We're going to have to eat that one. We'll eat her first.
Just what are you trying to pinch me for? Stop that.
Yeah, stop that. No, I'd love to get up there. I mean, that would be a lot of fun. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, you guys got to come up. It's great.
It is.
Well, I mean, what a great experience. I mean, between being in the great outdoors and a beautiful location like that, and then to have such a fascinating place.
Oh, yeah.
And the stars and the mountains at night.
Yeah.
Oh, the sky is amazing.
I believe it. The only place close to that we've gotten to something like that was up in Maine. Barbara has relatives up there.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Oh, wow.
And at night, you can see. Really, it feels like the stars feel like you know, blades of grass. I mean, it's just so tightly packed and incredible. So, love to see that. Well, what time of year? I mean, I know you've been up there already for the investigation, but generally, what time can you get up there? When would you start doing investigating, and when would you actually, if people want to go with you, how do they contact you to do that?
You can contact us through our website, or just contact us through our website. There's a thing on there about Wellington Tours at nwpia.com. And
what is? We've actually started digging our way in as of now.
Yeah. Funny story. We decided to try to get in again yesterday, and we spent an hour digging the truck out of the snow because I decided to get a little too crazy, and sunk the Toyota into a huge pile of mess. So I would give it. I think the end of this month or end of next month is about when the
We're keeping our fingers crossed. Every year is different. Last year wasn't until June. About the middle of June until we can get down there. This year we're kind of hoping for May.
Yeah. Did you guys have to hike when you went?
You know, we hiked a couple feet, took a look down the road, and saw what. There's a bigger mess before you. You know, it melts. The snow melts from the bottom up.
Yeah.
So as you're walking along, you actually drop into these little crevices and.
Yeah.
Yeah, we hiked back to the truck and left.
Bummer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, and I would say that although we were there on March 1st of this year, there was a reason that we had a really warm winter. And we were able to get in, and the risk of avalanche was low. But I wouldn't recommend for people. An avalanche occurred there on March 1st. And so I would strongly suggest that people not try to get in like we did. Do as I say, not as I do, right?
Yeah. And, you know, when we tried to get in a few weeks ago, or it was about a month ago, and it turns out we have a friend of ours, or an investigator that got his big truck. I mean, this thing's like a diesel tank, stuck all the way up to the axles. And we had to go retrieve his laptop and his camera and everything else. And as we were doing that, we heard the scream of a cougar no more than maybe 20 yards away from us. And it reminds you that you're in the wilderness. Even though you have all these wonderful trucks and tools and technology is great, you're at the mercy of teeth, big,
yeah.
Gigantic teeth.
Yeah.
Hungry, big, gigantic, hungry teeth at this time of year.
You're on their turf.
Yes.
Yeah,
no.
Exactly.
So we quickly moved, ran back to the, or walked quickly back to the Jeep, and we got everybody out of there okay. But,
And we do share these stories with our spirit friends once we get into the snowshed on what we had to do to get there to see them.
Yeah.
Well, that's one thing that you do have to, I mean, that the spirits are going to have an advantage over you for. Oh, yeah, so you're still worried about cougars and things. I remember that.
Yeah, exactly.
We think they might watch and laugh, actually.
Yep.
Yeah,
some of it.
Laugh a lot.
Digging up snow and hiking to get in there.
Yeah.
Only to be eaten by a mountain lion or a cougar. That
would. No kidding.
That's too quick, too fast. I wouldn't want to have that happen.
Yeah.
No.
Karen put it, you just have to be the one running the fastest.
No. You just have to be faster than one other person. You don't have to be the fastest. Just faster than one other person.
Yeah. The last person out is not really a person as much as they are prey, I think.
Lunch. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to be doing that. Well, so, I mean, if again, this is such a rich story. There were so many people, so many lives. I mean, each of you must have had one experience that just jumps out at you as something that you want to remember. What would that be for each of you?
Well, I'll start, and mine is that it was the last time that we were up there this summer fall before it started snowing, and we were having a party to sort of celebrate that we'd gotten through the summer of filming, and also just to thank the spirits for what they do and for being willing to communicate with us. And I was walking down the snowshed with a friend and down in Area 61, this place that all summer had given me such apprehension. all of a sudden standing in front of me in the middle of the snowshoe, in the middle of the trail, was this very solid black figure, probably 6 feet or taller. And it had, he had density and he had dimension. And as soon as I looked up and saw him, he disappeared.
Wow.
So that was mine.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Mine probably was definitely when I saw No Face up there. That was the first time I've ever seen a white apparition. And it was standing directly behind Bert and side by side with another investigator named Tim. And it was like I turned around and they, all three of them turned around to look at me like, what's going on? And I'm like, okay, there's Bert, there's Tim, and who are you? You know, it was like he was looking at me and I was looking at him like, what are you doing? And it was like they all three turned around and he just disappeared.
Wow. How tall was the spirit?
He was, Tim is probably close to 6 foot tall, and he was taller than Tim by maybe like 4 or 5 inches.
Really? That much bigger?
Wow. And not significantly tall, not like he would be a giant, but, you know, he was a bit taller than Tim, and I think after going up there after so many years and standing there and not hearing things on some nights and freezing your butt off on some nights, and it was pretty significant. That moment just made everything worthwhile.
Could you tell a little bit of how No Face was dressed? I mean, could you detect certain things about his attire?
I didn't really see any of his attire because it was like he was standing directly behind Bert and then side by side by Tim. All I could see was kind of his shoulders, neck, and head area. And it didn't look like he had a hat on or anything like that, so I didn't get to see any other features besides that, unfortunately. Maybe this year.
Yeah. Well, Bert, that leaves you.
It does. I think that my most memorable experience is pretty much everybody else's. I'm probably one of the only ghost researcher or hunter out there that never sees anything. You know, I'll hear things. Last year, I heard my name, which I thought was pretty cool. But that once again could have been me making it up. You know what I mean? I feed off of everybody else's stories. I feed off of their positive energy, their excitement, and that's what keeps me going. So when Jamie and Karen had their experiences, it's sort of like mine. I haven't had really anything up at Wellington that just stands out. The little mice things that were running across and the lady humming, that was cool.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. So yeah. I feed off everybody else's story. I'm sort of like that ghost hunter leech.
Will you knock that off, please?
Sorry.
Can I tell you my husband's? Because I think his is fairly significant, because this is a man whose background is in nuclear engineering, and he's very scientifically based and makes no bones about how skeptical he is about the existence of ghosts and has for years. But we were up there one night in Area 61. It was Jim and I and our children. And he was fiddling with some camera equipment, and he had a camera, and then he had three different IR lights, and all three of them were on separate power supplies, and two of them, or three lights had mechanical slider switches.
Uh-huh.
And we were standing in Area 61, and all of a sudden, all three of those things went off at once. And it's not that the batteries drained, it's that those mechanical switches turned themselves off. And so did his camera, and so did my recorder that I was carrying, and a camera that my stepson was carrying. And all of these things turned off at once, where it had to be something mechanical that caused those switches to slide over to the other side of the off position.
And they all coordinated.
It was in the exact same moment, yeah.
Wow.
Now, skeptical or not, that should get your attention.
he believes Wellington is haunted. Yeah.
Oh, that would be a fascinating and not entirely great thing to go through. But afterwards, I mean, after you kind of recognize what happened and you go and you change your shorts and you come back. And
oh, it's cool. It's sometimes it's scary, but usually it's just cool. When I saw that shadow figure, I was jacked. I came back to everybody in the parking lot and I was, you know, I was excited. It was cool.
Oh, I mean, I'm being a little facetious.
Yeah. Obviously.
I mean, that would be a tremendous contact. That would be tremendous.
Yeah. I was going to ask, have you guys brought psychic mediums up there with you?
Bert?
Actually, our group hasn't, no.
Well, there have been some from other groups who have gone up.
Well, I would love to do that. Like I say, it's a long way for us, but we could. Bart, we'll have to talk, Bert and
sure.
Jamie, and see how we could facilitate something like that, because that's something we've gotten into. We've been doing a lot of investigating, and I'd like to think I'm able to pick up on names that might be very helpful.
That would be cool.
That'd be awesome.
Because we actually, Barbara and I did an investigation of a train station down here.
Yeah.
And it was it actually had been a station, and I think did they move that, or were there other buildings that were moved towards that?
No, that was the original train station.
It was the original train station that had been there since the late 19th century, I guess.
Wow.
And it was an area. Actually, it's in Newhall, California, and the area was developed by an appointee of Abraham Lincoln. So it goes back quite a ways. And I got the guy's name. I walk in and I hear, oh, there's someone named Edward here. And I just, it's okay, Edward. And then Barb and I took a little walk, and what it was an old train station that was in the process of being turned into a museum. So it was kind of, it wasn't all put together. And I just felt like I got to get up and walk, and I didn't know why. And we walked over, and then Barbara shined a light on the wall, and there was a portrait of Edward Beale.
We stopped
right in front of him. And I'm walking in the dark, and my flashlight, of course, went out too, by the way. Gosh knows those spirits love to do that.
Yeah, they do.
It's one way to get your attention. And Edward Beale was, I kept hearing, I did all of this. I made this. And so, and then one of the people who works at the museum, I was just basically talking out loud. Edward says he did all of this. There's a guy, Edward, here. He says he's responsible for all this, and it turns out that Edward Beale was responsible for developing something that became called the Beale Cut, which was a cut in the mountains that opened up a trail between northern and southern California.
Oh, cool.
That was a pretty big deal.
So that was kind of, I just walk around. I don't know. I mean, I'm wrong sometimes. I mean, I know I am, and if anyone says they're right all the time, run. Just say thank you very much, have a nice day, and get away. but I'd like to think I'm right often enough, and it was a really interesting thing. So it would be my second train investigation, if that helps.
Yeah,
that would be awesome.
That
especially
would be really
if
awesome.
We can get some names out of them.
Yeah, something.
Well, we got some names that we definitely want to try from when I had this psychic reading for the article I was writing, and it turned out to be all of these characters from Wellington. So we got some names, and we haven't had the opportunity to do anything with it yet, but we want to try.
Well, don't tell me, so I'd rather not know until I'm up there. And if you don't mind, I mean, I'd love.
Yeah, don't read the article I wrote for the magazine then.
Oh, I never read any. No, I mean, I take that back. In fact, and all kidding is I'm a big dope sometimes, Karen, but you know that.
I know
now.
You are.
And now everybody knows that, so that's okay. But you wrote you're in the process of writing a very nice article about us. We've just
June issue. Yep.
And that I have to tell you, your magazine really is. It's just some of the enthusiast magazines. They don't have the quality of writing and the art directing. You can see that it's okay. It's just a bunch of people that, and this is good. There's nothing wrong with that. that are enthusiastic about the topic, but you bring real professionalism to it. And I think
that's
a good reflection on everyone associated with it, including, like, Barb and I are very fortunate to be in an upcoming issue. And
Bert and Jamie have been featured in an issue, too. Do you remember what month that was?
That was in August. August.
Probably August, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. It was August. Yeah, I agree. Karen's one hell of a writer. I mean,
thank you.
You know, it's.
I get to talk to you guys every night.
Need a little ego boost just so you know where to get a hold of us. We're on Skype, and it's easy, cheap, fast, you know, so.
And she's funny. And her blogs, you know, the Nesma. Oh, help me out, Karen. What's
Namaste.
The name?
Namaste.
Thank you. We read all of your blogs, of course, you know that.
Everything
that you write, we read just because it's. You know, sometimes it's very serious, and other times it's really, really, really funny. And especially Tanner being pushed down a 20-foot cliff by a...
fifth-grade girl.
Yeah.
With a crush on him.
Yep.
Yeah.
And of course, we loved your blog on how you described our 100-year trip to Mountain.
Yeah. That was something else.
that was on Paranormal Underground, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, if there are any writers out there that... need scripts, Karen's available.
That's right.
Well, Karen,
thank you, Bert.
Well, we should talk about that because I'm just blurting it out. Wouldn't that make a great show for Discovery Channel or something like that? 100-year anniversary or something like this.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And it doesn't have to just be on March 1st. It can be this year.
Right. Yes.
Yep.
Yes. And a one-off wouldn't be a bad idea.
No, I think it's wonderful. Karen's kind of the framework behind all this. Stuff. She just emails us and we'll go, okay. You know, we're for it. You know, whatever you want to do. We'll come pick you up. I don't care. Let's go.
We provide all the craziness in between.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, I'm really happy that you guys were doing this with me tonight because I've done a lot of interviews about the book and I really feel that it's more your story than my story. I just wrote it. And so I was really excited that you guys were going to be doing this with me tonight. I think it's great.
Well, thank you. It touches, Wellington has only touched very few people, myself, Jamie, and Karen, I think, we have been touched the most about the story of Wellington and the people really that are there, you know, there are living or dead friends.
Yeah,
it's definitely one of those places, and hopefully, you know, Mark, you guys will be able to come up there. It's one of those places when you step into it, you... either love it with everything you have, or you're just okay with visiting it maybe once or twice a year. And that's kind of what we find when we bring newer people up there. They're just either in love with the place and can't leave it and can't wait to come back, or they're just okay with doing a quick visit.
Yeah, and Karen has bragging rights. She was digging as much as everybody else and trudging through the snow.
And freezing.
And hiking freezing. In there, yes. Oh, my God, was she freezing. But never had a bad attitude, you know, never got upset about it, nothing. It was
wanted to be there.
Well, tonight, you guys, you've shared the story with people across the United States and the U.K.
Oh, wow.
Awesome. Yeah,
that's cool.
And then we'll put this up as a podcast, and a couple thousand more people will pick it up around the world. We have people. Yeah. Barbara keeps track of this closer than me, but
we'll have people all over the world knowing about this.
Oh, wonderful!
Great. Yeah. So can I tell you where to buy the book?
I would insist on it.
Well. There is actually a website for the book, and there's a little more information. I've put some other information and some pictures and things on that website, and that is avalancheofspirits.com. And the book is available on most major e-tailers. It's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And if you go to Paranormal Underground, there's a little link that will take you to a place where you can buy it. And then it's also on my website, which is KarenFrazier.com, F-R-A-Z-I-E-R. I didn't know how to spell it till I married him, so I always spell it.
Well, and I'll just, my own two cents, that I really did enjoy going through it because, you know, so often you don't know who these people were before they were spirits. And I think you give us a little bit of that, and it makes their story more important.
Yeah. Well, and there are a couple other books that I can recommend if people really want to sort of get an idea of the people that were involved in this very dramatic real-life situation. One of the books is called The White Cascade, and the author is Gary Crist, K-R-I-S-T. And then the other one is a book. It's actually a novel, but it's such an amazingly well-researched novel. He wrote it as a novel, I believe, just because he had to sort of imagine some of the dialogue. But it's called Vis Major, V-I-S Major, and the author is Martin Burwash.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't read a lot, and Vis Major to me was a very, it seemed to, as you read it, he places you in a, sort of like you're there. And, I'm not a real emotional guy, but at the end, I wept like a baby. Jeez. Vis Major is an awesome book. Karen's book is equally as awesome.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And, the whole place is just awesome. Awesome.
Well, you guys, I wanted to give her one last chance to. So, Karen has given her information about where people can find her. If anyone has a question, you can always if you can't remember that, you know where to find Barbara and I at Mark at Positively Psychic, and Psychic Spouse at Positively Psychic. Mm-hmm. And so you can reach us there too. Bert. And Jamie, where can people find you again if they wanted to go up for a tour, if they wanted to go up and learn more, if they wanted to just email you? How do they get a hold of you?
You could just go right to our website. It's nwpia.com. And it's right on the front page. There's a little chat box. You get a hold of me through Bert Coates at nwpia.com. It goes directly to the old personal email box.
Well, Bert and Jamie, we really appreciate your telling your story. It's a great story, and I hope that clearly you're doing justice and doing honor to the memory of these people who died so tragically up there. And I want to thank you for doing that.
Sure.
And I'm sure that, I'd like to think that they're aware of what we're doing too, because it isn't just this linear little world where they can only be in one place, or they can only know certain things.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I'd like to think that I do believe that they can pick our brains and know a certain amount of what's going on. So,
yeah.
I think we have to take a summer trip.
A summer trip would be fabulous.
Yeah, really, anybody that wants to come up here, please contact us. We'll take you up there. It is such a beautiful spot. I don't give it justice by saying it's awesome.
It's awesome.
It's awesome. Yeah.
Well, the photo in the front of Karen's book is, it really is a nice job, Jamie. It's a beautiful shot.
Thank you. We would love to have you guys up here and share Wellington with you.
It sounds fabulous. It really does.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you guys for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
And I'm sure I have to say, Karen, we'll probably have another reason to call you in a few weeks. So I. But seriously, I do want to talk more, and it would probably include Bert and Jamie as well about an idea that's percolating in my little head. So,
cool.
Well, you email that to me, because we have plans we're trying to put into motion too. So email it to me as soon as you can.
I will.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, guys. Have a good evening.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You too.
Bye.
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 Well, I have to tell you, Barb. I feel really privileged to have been able to spend some time with those guys. Great story. Just a really special investigation. Like so many of the people tonight who are listening, they probably have been out on investigations, but certainly nothing but this kind of a wilderness location and feel.
Yeah, I would just like to go up there to find out who these spirits are. I think you would definitely get some names.
I would love to walk
and
in.
you would tell their stories,
I'd like to think that we could, Barb, and that'd be something worth talking about. And we'll be in touch with Karen certainly and Bert and Jamie to see if there's something we can do to help make this happen.
Right.
Bring
some more attention to
We've got some people we're always pitching down here, and might be a good idea. Barb and I also had an interesting investigation this weekend.
Yes, we did.
Barb, why don't you tell people about it?
Well, you want me to tell?
You can do a little talking. I have it on my nose. If I don't, I'm done.
Okay. Well, we were invited with 3 a.m. Paranormal to go to the Sybil Brand Correctional Facility in Los Angeles, California. And for those of you who remember back in 1968-69, the Sybil Brand Correctional Facility was where they took the three girls from the Manson Tate murders, you know.
Manson
family murders, the three girls. I forget their names.
It's unimportant.
But anyway, that's where they stayed for a little while. And but anyway, the actual facility is empty now. They closed it in 97, and it's used as a filming set. They you know, use it in films as a prison or whatever. And but it's abandoned. And but there's still a lot of energies there because there were some suicides. Some of the girls committed suicide horribly because, you know, they didn't have weapons and stuff, so they figured out other ways.
Blades and people hanging each other.
Yeah, they right. They would hang themselves in the showers, and anyway, just really sad. And the prison itself was supposed to have like room for 900. Inmates, and at its peak, they ended up having over 2,800 inmates. They had beds stacked three levels high. They had bunk beds three levels high in these open dorms, if you can imagine. And so, you know, stuff was going to happen. And I guess it was one of the most violent facilities, or there was a lot of.
Well, it was a place, Barb, that had. Everything from minimal to maximum security. It was a facility just for women. And actually, the people who brought us there were, like Barbara was saying, Joe, Rebecca, and Marsha from 3 a.m. Paranormal. Marsha's husband, V, couldn't make it, so next time. But we've really enjoyed going out and investigating with them. But we heard a lot of things that night. There was, what can I tell you? One of the things that really jumped out for me is I felt like there was someone standing behind me. It was like right before we left, we were getting kind of dog tired about 1 a.m. But I said, I asked one of the people there who's actually going to be coming up on a show, Nicole, who, well, she's an author who is with Friends of 3 a.m. Paranormal. She's written a book on ghosts of Southern California. She was there and took a picture. And behind me, there was a orb about almost half the size of my body on the picture. So it was a huge orb, and I felt like there's somebody there. And so it wasn't any little bubble. If you look, if we'll have to put that up on our site, Barbara, if you haven't already, on
MySpace.
Yeah. Love to put that up, because to me it was just one of those things when it's like there's someone standing behind me, take a shot, and then you see this big orb. It's like, okay, I'm going to call that a validation.
But I think where we got our most experiences was in the infirmary, where they held.
Yes.
They had
The showers.
Well, the infirmary was the most, because remember we had it was on the second floor, and that's where they would keep like terminally ill inmates, or you know, inmates that had gotten stabbed, or you know, whatever. So there was a lot of unsettled energy in that area, and we were in a group of about, 20 people, and we all had our K2s, which were going off, like, unbelievably on cue, you know, they were going off together. I mean, it wasn't just one going off,
yeah.
And I'm sure Joe and Rebecca got some EVPs from that night. And people were hearing things, you know, like behind them and down the hall, and you know, it was pretty active. That area was very active.
Well, you took a photo up in one of the showers, and there was a big orb right over where I guess
the,
one of
the bar.
Yeah, I'm gonna sneeze again. Oh, excuse. Good rating. Oh, excuse me. Well, Barbara took a shot. That was a place where, actually, very tragically, a suicide took place. But there appeared to be a lot of orb activity in that area. While it is a dusty place, I cannot just say that's just another orb. It certainly seemed to have a lot of size and texture to it, which I think makes it very interesting.
Yeah.
The kitchen. That was a creepy place. There was some rooms back there, actually, that were pretty bad.
You're gonna sneeze. Just imagine this huge kitchen because you got to feed 900 inmates or more, and everything was stainless steel. And we went back into this one area that was a freezer, you know, where they'd keep all the hamburger or whatever they were going to cook. And there was a huge fan in there. So actually, you could take someone in the freezer and do whatever, you know, if you wanted to get rid of them or whatever. And no one would hear you because they had the big fan blowing. So if someone were to scream or, you know, yell for help, you would never hear them. So anyway, there was a murder in that freezer, so Mark and I went back in there, and he was starting to pick up on who that was. And do you remember what you said? Well, it was a woman that they dragged in there and beat her up or something.
Going into this place, you guys, I mean, some locations just scream tragedy, and this is one of those. I mean, there was a place with no windows. There was a place in the back that if you were quiet, I mean, there was, I felt violence all around it. And I have to tell you, it was just not a place I wanted to linger, you know. And first walking in, remember, it's amazing. If you think like a convict, we walked up this one ramp. And as we're walking up this ramp, there's like an area above us, and immediately I started to get a headache. It felt like a long, jagged, you know, pain on the top of my head. When we got to the top of the stairs, we actually had sheriffs with us too, because it's actually, the building is still under the control of, I guess, the sheriff's department. They told us that an inmate had been thrown off the top of this.
Oh, yeah.
Walk and had been had died after hitting their head on the bottom of the stairs. It's like, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah,
Barbara's K2 meters lighting up. My head's hurting, and they had actually had to. They put fencing over the top of this to prevent other people from being thrown.
Yeah.
Off of this,
and you know, we're not talking like 3 feet or even 6 feet. This thing had to be what, 20 feet?
Over 20 feet, I'd say over 20 feet.
Yeah.
Because it's a large facility, and it was definitely...
Yeah, and if you really wanted to get back at somebody, you just throw them over the side, and there you go. And the whole, I mean, it's just concrete. It's all concrete, so it's not like you're going to make a soft landing.
No.
So it was not a happy place. It was exhausting being in there because it was so very negative and just an awful place. I mean, really bad.
Yeah, my advice, if you don't go to jail. It's not worth it. It's not worth it. It's not worth the risk. I would definitely recommend that you stay out of jail. The thing, too, that when we were there, I mean, the thing that you just don't see is, like, the intense number of people in a space. You know, the idea that they had over three times the number of people that should have been in there. I guess they just figured out, well, we can keep stacking those bunks. And so they had like bunk beds three, you know, stacked three high and, you know, edge to edge. So it was a tough location. So, but we're very glad to have Joe and Rebecca. And we should probably have them on to talk about that.
Yeah. And the thing is that they don't let other paranormal groups in there. I don't think like some of the other ghost adventures or, you know, they don't allow too many groups in there. In fact, 3M Paranormal is one of the only.
I think they may be the only.
They're the only one that they allow in there. So we were very privileged to be a part of that group.
One thing I wanted to let people know too is that in our upcoming week, we're going to have, if you liked our show about the crop circles, well, I think you'll like next week's. We're going to have author Michael Glickman, who has written a book on Bones of the Gods. And he has written a definitive book on crop circles. I think you're going to find him really interesting. He's another guest from England. I'm so thankful that we're able to get people who are willing to stay up at 3 in the morning in England to speak with us. It's a great book. I'll be, again, Bones of the Gods. And it talks about some of the many, many experiences. He gives some wonderful explanations of what happens and why they happen and his theories, and I think that you'll really enjoy them. He was mentioned by Suzanne Taylor, who was she was the documentary filmmaker we had on a few weeks ago. And so Barb and I found that to be a subject matter that was it grabbed me. I used to just think, I didn't really give it much serious thought. But if you start to pay attention to the reality of this, like so many things in the paranormal, it makes you start to think about the other things that are true. So if crop circles may be too real to dismiss, then that means that this may be true, and that may be true. And so that gets rather complicated. And it pushes you to think. Barb, do I have time for a reading? If someone wants to call in for a reading.
We have time for that.
No, we've got a little bit of time. If someone wants to call in for a reading, it's 818-574-8412. 818-574-8412. I think I'm getting a cold.
Oh, no. I was going to say, also, too, coming up, QueenCon. Next week.
Next week. 2 weeks.
No way. It's
next week.
The 30th.
Not this Saturday, a week from this weekend.
Yeah, next week.
What are you trying to say? You're saying it's Barbara's trying to say it five different ways, and I'm arguing.
I can't wait. I wish it was this weekend.
Yeah, it's not going to be this weekend. It's going to be the next weekend or next week.
Yeah, and we're actually, they're going to be filming Mark's psychometry demonstration, so we'll try and get that up on either the Podomatic or... Our friends from APRA are going to be filming Mark in his session. It's a one-hour psychometry session, and we'll try and get that up on either MySpace or Podomatic so you can actually see how Mark does that, so it's going to be fun.
Yeah, actually, last week we took a Thursday off for... It's ironic, we take our Thursday night show off, and it ended up being like the busiest week that we've had in some time. So, investigation Saturday, I did a presentation. It was kind of a fun thing. I wanted to thank people at Rocks and Runes. They allowed me to participate, and there were about 15 people that I was able to do a session for. And that's I've done for a lot more than that, but they were a great group in a small room. And I basically, they all brought forth things that they wanted me to touch, hold, and look at. And I was able to do that. And we have a call. Hello, this is Mark. Is this Tinner?
Hey. No, this is Sandy.
Sandy, how are you?
Oh, wait, here we go.
I am fine. How are you?
I'm good. Barbara, we're going to have to stay with...
Was that Tanner?
Hi, is this Sandy?
This is Sandy.
Uh-huh. Hi, Sandy. Did you have a question for me?
Yeah, I kind of wanted a general reading. There's a lot of odd stuff going on around me, medically, with myself, with everybody else.
Well, the first thing, why don't we focus on a medical issue?
Mm-hmm.
Are you having some heart issues?
Yes, heart. Uh-huh.
Okay. I would say that this is going to be something that you're going to have to, your diet is actually going to have something to do with fixing this.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like it's sapping your energy really badly.
Okay,
this feels like something that you can correct. I feel like you're going to, if you're on a medication for this right now is what it feels like.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I think that you're going to need to stay with this for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
But I also feel like I'm seeing you being able to wrap this up, so it doesn't feel like you're going to be on this for life.
Ah.
So, in fact, I get the visual that like you're kind of wiping your hands of this. So there's two ways I'm going to look to interpret that. Either you're going to be switching medications, and this one is going to probably not be the long-term answer, or you're going to be able... What you're on is good. You're going to eventually get off of this, is what I'm seeing, feeling. I feel that you probably will end up replacing it with something else.
Mm-hmm.
But this feels like something you can control. Is it like palpitations or like a
I had a stent put in my heart recently.
Okay.
And a blockage and a blood clot. And okay. So I've been exercising, changing my diet, and going to cardiac rehab.
Good girl.
Yeah.
Well, what I would tell you is that I feel that this is something you can, it's not life-threatening, although if you didn't treat it, it would be life-threatening. So, but you've made the right decisions, you're doing the right things. And I'm being told for you to watch out for some of the thinners. I mean, I almost feel like they may be putting you on a blood thinner at some point that may be too much.
Oh, yeah, now.
So, that's the only, I think it's necessary, but look to see how you can get that. I feel like you'll be able to replace the blood thinner. If that's what you're on now, I think that's going to be something that changes.
The Plavix.
If you're on Plavix, okay.
And aspirin.
Okay, I just feel like that this is not forever. I feel that if anything, if you're on Plavix now, that's going to change at a certain point. It's not hurt. I mean, being told it's not hurting you, I do feel like you are clearly on the road to recovery. But it just doesn't feel like this is the thing you're going to be taking. You're not on. I don't feel like not for the rest of your life. Not for the rest of your life. Okay.
Well, that's good news. And very quickly, because I know Tanner wants to get on, but can you read anything about my friend who's going to have surgery for her breast cancer on Monday, a lumpectomy? I don't know if you can do that.
What's her name?
Lori.
I feel like that it will not be the first, be the only surgery. I feel like that this is something, I mean, this will provide some initial relief. I feel like that she may have a recurrence. But I feel that this is a good and right thing to do, and they will do a good job, and this will extend her life.
Okay, good.
I don't see this as being... she has years left. That's how it feels to me. But I feel like it's cancer would be popping back up. I'm sorry. I mean,
yeah.
It just feels like it would be.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
But she does get a couple of good years at minimum. And that, like I say, I'm not always told, I mean, I'm not told so-and-so will die this day. I mean, I'm not supposed to be the one to tell you that. But what I do see is that the surgery does provide her with time. And that...
But not a lot.
You know what? I think I see her hair growing back. Does she have kind of wavy brown hair?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
She's worried about her hair than anything else.
And I can tell you that I see her hair growing back to like her shoulders at least.
Oh, wow. Okay, good.
Okay. So I see nice wavy brown hair going back down to her shoulders. That is some idea of how much time she would have.
Okay. And how much what?
That'll give you at least a small idea that she has time.
Okay.
If you guys would like to call me, Market Positively Psychic, and I'll be marketpositivelypsychic.com. Glad to help. Okay.
Okay, you're great. Thanks
Thank
a
you
lot.
So much. Have a good night.
Thanks, Sandy.
You too.
Bye, Sandy.
Bye.
Okay, I guess we have Titter, who was trying to get a hold of us, but if she wanted to call back, that would be great. I appreciate. I know it's late in many parts of the country, and I'm happy to assist. I'm also glad that I was able to pick up on something positive for Sandy.
Yeah,
you know, about her heart. So next week is like I say, Michael Glickman is going to be a great guy. I don't know. I love English accents, and we have our call. Hi, this is Mark. Hello. Is this Tanner? I can hear you breathing, but I don't hear you speaking.
Who is this?
Okay, it's, if someone, I wish I could hear you. I can.
Oh, you know what? They have to turn on your, be sure and make sure the audio is on your microphone so we can hear on Skype.
Well, we'll try that again. We'll be here for a little bit more. Barbara.
Let's try it again.
Hello, this is Mark.
Now can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, I can. And I bet now you were yelling.
Me.
I bet you were yelling.
No, I've actually, Mark, I have a request for a reading. I'm dealing with a malevolent spirit. Not exactly certain how to handle it. I'm letting my guides do what they can. But I just need to know what you can pick up on him and why he's here.
I feel like that I feel like you went to on a investigation and you kind of brought it home with you.
That is very, very, very possible.
And did you take something from that investigation with you?
The dolls.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay.
Welcome to my world.
Aha. Uh-huh. Because I feel like that you brought something back, and that thing wants to stick around. I would say that, you know what I'm going to tell you is I'm going to ask you, you know, it's almost like spraying something in a dog's face and they don't like it. I feel like holy water might be just a thing to douse those spirits and what will annoy them and push them away. So I don't know if you're able to get to a Catholic church.
Oh yes. I frequent St. Joseph's quite regularly.
Okay, if you can get a small bottle, get it some spray. You don't need to fill it entirely with holy water. I think that those spirits will find that very annoying. I would ask them to leave and give them the option. It's like, if you don't leave me alone, this will happen, and I don't think you'll like that. So. I'm giving you the chance to leave me alone. I would also say prayers for that those malevolent spirits. So you're not just, you know, tweaking the tiger's nose. You know, you're doing something that's generous. So I would ask you to do that. So if you could say a prayer for whatever spirit is there and ask them to leave kindly, and then if you find that this spirit is lingering, then I would break out the bottle of holy water. They're not going to like that. And keep the holy water handy. Because, I'm no longer a practicing Catholic, but I believe in the beautiful intentions attached to holy water and the powerful intentions. And I think that matters.
Yeah, and the biggest thing that I've found is I'm actually a natural channeler.
Uh-huh.
So it's not a good situation for me to have one like him around.
Uh-huh.
Because they don't have any regard for your personal space.
No, no, no. And I would ask you to surround yourself in white light. I'm sure you're doing some
mm-hmm.
sensible protections. But if you believe that there are some objects that are associated with the spirit, hit them with some holy water. It just that's something that feels sensible. And But only after you say, look, this is, I need you to leave me alone. This is, you're not welcome here. And that I'm asking you to leave. And I'm praying for you. And those
yes,
things.
And
like,
you know, the dolls, I think you did around the dolls for me.
Yes.
And a female spirit came with them initially.
Mm-hmm.
And she's fine. She doesn't bother me. It's not an inconvenience.
Mm-hmm.
But this has been in the last 3 or 4 days. It's like it came on a little later.
Huh. Okay. Well, keep it around you. If you feel that there is a negative entity in and around you, give it a spray. Okay. But I feel that by surrounding your, I do a lot of visualization. I think visualization
mm-hmm.
is it matters and it works.
Okay.
Okay. Well, Well, Tina, all right. We're going to have to wrap up, but I look forward to speaking with you next time, and I'd love to hear how it goes.
I will let you know.
Let me know next week, and maybe we can talk about it a little more then.
Okay, will do.
Tina, have a wonderful night. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Tina.
You too, Mark.
Bye. Well, that wraps up another Positively Psychic week. Barbara, hey, thank you, honey, for being here with us and doing this with me.
That was a great show.
Good show. Again, Karen, Bert, and Jamie, thank you so much for being with us. We'll be in touch about this idea for an event. And again, next week, Michael Glickman, author of Bones of the Gods.
From England
on crop circles. So until then, have a positively psychic week. Thank you for listening, and good night.
And we'll see you next week.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, everyone. And look for us at QueenCon.
This has been a Para-X production, sponsored by CBS Radio. We'll see you next week on Positively Psychic. You've been listening to Positively Psychic on Para-X Radio, the Internet's leading paranormal radio network, with listeners from around the world. Each week, we bring you cutting-edge paranormal radio, with fascinating interviews and call-in readings from your host, Mark Christopher Nelson. So tune in each week, Thursday evening, 7 Pacific, 10 Eastern, on Para-X Radio. We'll see you next time on Positively Psychic.
Your source for everything paranormal, Para-X.